said Niall. They were in front of T4, where Cor held court, all the little unborns with their close haircuts looking like pebbly sandpaper, watched this exchange. A covey of rollers, hats turned three quarters, kept an eye on them too. Hardcore was looking straight at Niall now, his brown eyes over full. Hardcore had a face. He had wrinkles and little brown marks. He had a scar over his nose and the teardrop beneath his eye. Hardcore's face said time.
"Mm-hmm," said Cor.
And Niall knew he'd told him way too much now.
"How it is,"
Hardcore said a few days later,
"is I got this little thing I need for you to be doing. Need you to take me something over in the jail."
Ordell had a way when there was something he wanted. He lowered his face so his eyes rose to you like dark suns. Edgar did it too, funny as that was. Cor was up on 17, Central, he called it, like it was some military command or police headquarters. It was really just some old lady's apartment that BSD, like, essentially stole.
"Just this here one time," Cor said. "We tight, you know. Then, you know, this whole money thing, man, that be back in the days. We go do our community organizing shit. Vote for your daddy and who all. Right?"
Cor never said what Niall was supposed to do. But Niall knew he wasn't that out of it. He knew it wasn't good. And he took a pass. The first time. Just made a face like, "Get a grip," and walked out. But of course Hardcore was back at it the next week.
"Bug gon' show you,"
Cor said this time, when Niall finally asked what he had in mind. Hardcore scratched his face and looked away, down to the street, where he could see his trade at work. From this apartment on 17, he looked right down on the intersection of Grace and Lawrence, a one-way street where he could observe Tic Tac coming from every direction. Cor was a genius, Niall thought suddenly, as he saw the point of being up here. Finally, Niall said,
"Show me." "Homegirl gon' show you," I said. "I'm not saying I'll do it. I just want to, you know, kind of see. See if you gon' get gaffled. The whole thing, how I'll feel. I want to kind of figure the whole thing." "You ain't gon' get cracked. You get cracked, man, first word out you mouth gon' be hardcore, ain't that right? Ain't that how it is? You gon' lighten the load, man, so I ain't gon' let you get cracked. I just want to see Lavinia show you."
So she walked him down the street to one of the crummy buildings on Lawrence, broken down three flats, brick buildings with boarded windows and lawns scuffled away to dirt. This was one of Cor's stash pads. Lavinia led him along, three steps ahead of him, talking to herself.
"I done told you," she said. "You think you way past cool, and I done told you."
She shook her head sorrowfully. The building was empty. On the first floor, one door was broken in, just smashed in half, the wood veneer broken off in crazy pieces. This was a crack house. Tic Tac was in and out of here once a month. The acerbic reek of the smoke remained, even though this week, with the last raid only days past, the place was deserted. There was no electricity, and the broad old stairwell in the walk-up was lit solely by a window on the fourth floor, which wasn't boarded. They moved upward through the cone of falling light. The railings had been ripped off the walls, the light fixtures stolen, the carpet runners, even some of the hard wood from the flooring had been scavenged. Gang signs were written in paint and marker on the walls. At the fourth floor, Bug stood with her finger across her lip. She wanted to see if they'd been followed. After quite some time, she led Niall back down to the second floor. There were heavy padlocks installed on each front door of the four apartments. Bug opened one of the middle ones with a key. The place was cold and empty. The linoleum floor had been picked up in places and was soiled in huge spots, which had lain under built-in units now removed. Bug piled through the cabinets in the kitchen till she found the balloon. Someone had left it there hours before, probably Hardcore. They both stood looking at it in her hand. About half a pound of straight coke in the condom, Niall figured. 10 years, minimum mandatory.
Where do I carry it?
Didn't he tell you nothing? You got to put it where they ain't gonna feel. Them suckers shake you down.
Barely.
Yeah, man, you can't be getting cracked with this shit.
I know that.
He actually laughed at that point.
Got to put it where they ain't gonna feel.
Which is where, man?
Lavinia got shy. Her eyes shot away like fish in water.
Oh, man, she said. How come I got to do everything?
She had the tape and some extra condoms in her pocket. She laid them down on a small wooden table in the kitchen beside the package.
This got to go in you little booty, okay?
No.
Uh-huh. Don't you be saying no. Here.
I'll do it. That's okay.
Come on, man. I gon' do it. Just that damn Hardcore get me sometime. Okay, boy. Come on.
Come on what?
Leave down you damn pants, man.
Jesus.
She took the balloon and massaged it. She took it in her two thin hands, working on it with her long fingers, squeezing it out. Just that was enough to get him started.
Come on, dude. Get with it.
He loosened his belt. He worked the pants down his thighs. She got behind him and pulled the elastic on his briefs down herself. Wait a minute, he thought. Wait a minute. He remembered then he had told Hardcore he just wanted to see. But there was nothing to say now. Bug had told him that on the way over. Core'd be ripping her if Niall didn't go ahead.
Okay now, bend you over. That's right. Come on. Put your hands on your cheeks. Okay.
Her fingers were chill and startling, but she started laughing.
You know, I don't think I ever seed a white one, like for real and all.
Really?
Mm-mm. Weird, you know. Man, you pale, man. Be kind of frightening.
Yeah, well, that's nice, he said.
Oh, you know, you okay?
She touched him soothingly.
Only I ain't used to it is all. You see the black girl?
Yeah.
He wasn't lying. In high school, there was one girl.
What her name? Now hold him apart. Go right there.
She ran her fingernail along.
Now it go like that. Now you can't put no tape over it, or it tear and bursts itself apart. You get that powder over that interview room, man, that's big time shit. So you put some threads, and we tape over them threads, okay?
She told him what he would have to do, who he'd be going to see. Core had planned it all.
So you been getting busy with some black chick, huh? You think that's right, huh? Black is best, huh?
It hadn't come to that, but he didn't say so now. She had her cool, thin fingers all over. She was playing, he knew it. She did too, and he started getting hard.
Shit, he thought, shit.
But something told him he really had no will to stop it. His briefs were still up in front, but he was sure she'd notice.
So you was liking that chick, huh?
She rubbed his ass with both hands. He had no idea what she thought she was doing.
It was a long time ago.
Can't barely remember, huh?
Man, you're playing me.
You don't seem to mind none.
She said it, and he didn't say anything. Yeah, you don't seem to mind. She came around the side, looked down, and then, shy as she was, dared his eyes.
What you got there? What you hiding?
She poked it, and he flinched. She laughed, laughed. I knowed you'd be lacking me. He didn't move. He didn't say anything, either.
You think I ain't never seen that?
You don't want to know what I seen. I seen that. She skirted her hand inside his briefs.
You getting scared now?
She laughed. She touched him. Just touched and drew her hand back and laughed some more.
Ain't you got nothing to say?
He was up now, stiff as steel.
Don't that feel good? She asked.
Yes. They both looked, her hand wrapped all around him. She sucked. That had never happened to Niall. That had never happened. She went around him in that cold apartment and took him in her mouth and dug her hands into his backside and pushed him back and forth the first few times. It didn't take long for him to be done. She went to one of the back rooms and spat.
Some girls say it make you sick. You think?
There was the virus, but he was clean. All county employees got screened each year. I don't think so. I learned something about it. Health class or something. I don't think it makes you sick. Health class. She loved that.
Don't say nothing to none of them,
she said when she reached the door.
God, no.
Then she smiled.
I knowed you'd be lacking me.
After that, it happened each week. He brought the dope in. The second or third time, he started bringing money out. Cor handed him half back, and Niall returned it.
Oh, man,
said Cor with disgust. He stuffed it into the pockets of Niall's trousers.
Damn, man, you too much, he said.
Niall kept the money in a carton in his closet. He figured he'd send it to Michael sometime, or buy something for Bug. Sometimes Lavinia and he fucked. There was a mattress there, and Bug rode him. She had tiny little pouchy breasts, and her ribs showed. She was so thin, it was frightening. There never seemed to be much in it for her. She was working. He was a man, and this was what men wanted. One thing Bug knew about was the world. She liked it when he said it felt good. She liked it when he said stuff afterwards. There were 100 things Niall wanted to ask her. Did Hardcore know? But Niall was pretty sure he didn't. Was it because he was white? But that was crude. Was it because he was nice? Which is what she was always saying. Had she ever done it for money? Had she done this for Hardcore?
Ain't you gonna touch me?
She asked him the next time, once they were in the apartment. He wanted to ask her 100 things, but nothing so much as this. What does it mean to you? Do you think about me all the time the way I think of you? Do you feel your skin surge? Do your hips and heart ache? What does it mean to you? He never really knew.
Dang, Edgar said.
He stood by the refrigerator, a hand planted on his forehead. This was how Edgar spoke in the privacy of his home, when Niall was around, as if Niall were still 3 years old. Imagine a person, a human being, ripping out a dang like he was Gomer Pyle or something. At moments, his father could do things, sniffle, pick his teeth, scratch, display a sign he was just as fucking dumb as everybody else, and Niall would hate him worse than any other person in his life. Because he couldn't get past him, couldn't get away. Sometimes Niall felt like some poor yapping mutt, a dog in the yard running this way and that, barking at you, charging in your direction, and never remembering till he was jerked back so powerfully his forepaws left the lawn, never recalling, hey, I'm tied to this goddamn stake in the ground. That was Niall. That was Edgar.
I keep forgetting about this, Edgar said.
He was holding the wad of notes he carried in his shirt pocket. It was strange to Niall how his father had turned into an old man. He was one of those strange old birds now, with everything he had to remember written on a paper in his pocket.
What? The money. Make sure you tell Ordell I'm going to get to it. I just don't know where it's supposed to come from.
He's okay about it.
You didn't tell him?
No. You mean where it went? No, I just said, you know, it'd be a little longer than we expected. He's cool, though. You know, I've been giving him some help.
Help?
Yeah, you know.
What kind of help?
Help? H-E-L-P?
As his probation officer?
Sort of. It's not important.
Wait. Wait, Niall. Pay attention. Look at me.
His father was at the kitchen table.
What are you doing?
Edgar,
wait. What are you doing, Niall?
Fuck you doing.
He stood in the fiery furnace.
Fuck you doing.
The question of his life.
Edgar. You could never really judge Edgar without seeing this. That's what he told himself. Those who scorned him, there were many, the reporters, the state house gutter snipes, the ugly clack tittering about loyal Edgar and his life of endless plotting. They could never really take account of him without seeing him as he lived here, in a three-room apartment carved out of the large house. He'd bought this house for June 25 years ago in the most grandiose gesture he could conceive of to reflect personal reform. It never mattered to her. She left anyhow, and over time he cut away the space. He had student roomers during the term, and in the winter a flop house in the basement for homeless men. But privacy, solitude, remained precious. Those parts of the house where others dwelled were sealed off from the smaller area Edgar and Niall occupied. Edgar's rooms were Spartan. He never bothered with carpets. The hard wood was chilly. He still fell wearily upon the same Danish modern sofa which had traveled from their place in Damon, its orange cushions covered with Guatemalan prints. There was nothing on the walls, only a single picture in a frame on an old maple coffee table. Niall, June, Edgar, in the late 60s. The boy with flossy curls, a hand upraised in childish jubilance. Bulwarks of books and papers were piled neatly. In his bedroom, the spread was tucked precisely beneath the outline of the pillow, leaving no sign of the man who was here in the middle of the night with the covers in turmoil. What did he think then? Did he wake with longing? And for whom? That is what people wanted to know, he realized. But he could not fully say himself. He recalled coming to in that state and instantly feeling somehow thwarted and ashamed. His mind quickly diverted. He spoke then to God, as he had done in moments of utter privacy all his life. For years, the bad years, as Edgar thought of them, when so much seemed beyond his control. In those years he would hide from himself the fact he did this, so that the disarming knowledge that he was still secretly conducting this conversation with him would come flying at Edgar out of nowhere, like a levitating object at a séance. He would think, how can it be? But he never stopped, for one reason. He listened. At that age of 4 or 5 or 6, somewhere far back there, one thick, summery southern night, with the locusts sawing themselves
In shrieks of desiccated passion, the intimation came to Edgar of the vast presence above, who heard with welcome Edgar's inner thoughts. God listened. Not always with patience or admiration, at times Edgar grappled with God as Jacob wrestled the angel. Sometimes in his dreams, Edgar saw them locked together, tussling, their naked flanks sweat glistered and etched in shadow. He felt the overheated breath, the ferocious, violent embrace of God nearly squeezing life from him, a sort of ecstasy arising amid the pain. Now, fresh from bed, he imagined everything he must do today, how he would be in the world. He recollected meetings, a staff lunch, committee members he needed to persuade, calls to Farmers Alliance members downstate, a constituent requiring help at the U. Tonight he would speak at a dinner in the South End in DuSable at a legal aid center function. Edgar had gone for years. Good folk, Irish, Italians, and Mexicans, organized around one of those parish priests, Father Halloran, still lean and energetic at 64, who'd been there 30 years, full of hope, kindling kindness amid the lives that would stand parched and lonely without him. Halloran kept his parishioners supporting this little clinic where the poor received free advice about overbearing landlords, their sad divorces, the kids in trouble on the street. Edgar loved these events, finding people, ordinary people, secretaries and shop floor managers, who cared to see the world made better, whose feelings ran beyond the boundaries of their lives. Their kids came too, half of them grown, moved off to the far-flung corners of the suburbs, but still drawn back to this, to the flame of their beliefs. He would talk about the pure good of this enterprise, no sentiment, but he'd say that good faith and caring are not government responsibilities alone. And they'd ask, Senator Edgar, they'd ask, what else can we do? What can we do? And for a minute, this hall, a basement room in a KFC hall, a place with cheap paneling and magenta carpeting, worn to a number of blackened spots, would be quiet. What can we do? The whole place would throb with the pained life of the poor. He did not know exactly what he'd say, but he savored the moment in prospect. In the State House, they could laugh at him all they liked. The staffers and media thugs could be smug. But this was still his work, still where he knew just who he was. When he felt both the torment of people warring all their lives against the dim weight of poverty and scorn, and the furious strength of his dedication to them. They never understood, men like Hardcore, men like Huey, they never recognized that it was a thrill to Edgar to see them. Black men, powerful, rigid with anger. It thrilled him to think these men were the heirs, the successors of the beaten, woebegone souls he'd watched chop tobacco during his childhood, men and women who grasped the spiny stems Edgar could not even touch, migrants moving listlessly, hopelessly up the dusty roads, carrying with them the odor of the thick, aromatic sap. He had loved those people, so cruelly thwarted by the likes of his father, adored them with a mighty, towering, limitless love. He did not love Hardcore or Huey. They did not want his love, which was one reason they frightened Edgar, much as they frightened everybody else. But he was thrilled because their strength, their anger, equipped them to move forward in the world. Now we must move beyond anger. That is what he would say tonight. We must move on to gratitude, participation, responsibility. Wide awake at the lee end of the night, he stared toward the ceiling fixture, the textured glass that captured the glaring light of two bulbs, and saw the brightness only as a tangible sign of his own commitments. Downstairs at this hour, past 5 a.m., he heard the ruckus of Niall, readying himself for departure. He was gone early on these days to avoid the traffic. It was an hour and a half sometimes from Greenwood into Kendall probation. He has been getting better, Edgar thought, knowing he had told himself this nearly Niall's entire life. But it seemed to be true. He was less edgy, more responsive, holding this job a real job with which he seemed legitimately involved. Yes, all right, he was still under his father's guidance, still hovered over at moments like a small child. But he was working where there was so much good to be done. Edgar proceeded downstairs to find his son in a denim shirt and a leather tie, eating cereal and watching the TV. "Hey," said Niall. His son still slept here 2 or 3 nights during the work week, if Edgar was not downstate. Niall's place in town was a lonely closet. Niall also passed the weekends here. The boy, the man, Niall had become. 6'1", sloppy with loose flesh, sprawled on the sofa, unshaved, unwashed, drinking name-brand beer in the living room downstairs and watching TV. They did not speak much. He was not sure what Niall wanted. Free food, a place to lounge and be looked after. There were 100 sarcastic answers, but he welcomed the boy's presence. Edgar liked to have him here in sight. They both felt better that way. Edgar had put on yesterday's shirt and found his notes in the pocket. "Dang," he said. He touched his forehead. "I keep forgetting. The money. Make sure you tell Ordell I'm going to get it. I just don't know where it's supposed to come from." "He's okay about it," Niall had offered, fixed on the TV, but the alarm had started faintly clanging. It was experience, nothing else. Edgar began to pursue him, until Niall said he had given Hardcore some form of help. "Wait, wait, Niall. Pay attention. Look at me." His father was at the kitchen table. "What are you doing?" How did he know? There was a look Niall had, a sly, shamed hound dog look, confronting the fact that the internal realm where he resided did not mesh with the one recognized at large. It was always frightening to observe this, and Edgar was petrified now. "I'm just helping out." "Helping what? On probation beefs? Are you throwing files away?" "Nothing like that. I do my job." "Where? What are you doing?" "In the jail," Niall said finally. It had come out in pieces. Edgar, who thought of himself as stoical and strong, had his head down on the table by the time the discussion was through. He wrapped himself in his own arms. He asked Niall many times to say it was a joke. As a boy, a teenager, Edgar thought every day of Jesus on the cross, as the nails drove through the flesh of his hands first, then his feet. Even as the nerve and bone was crushed, he must have welcomed his pain, knowing it would soon bring the world salvation. All his life, Edgar had tried to welcome pain, but he could not welcome this. "It's cool," said Niall, actually hoping to comfort him. "No, it's not cool. It is the most uncool, stupid, dangerous thing you could possibly be doing. It's crazy." "You think someone else wouldn't do this, Edgar?
There's so much shit in there. Just money, for God's sake. They're not supposed to have a nickel, and I bring out $5,000 a week.
Oh, Niall. In the rising biliousness, in the sense of delirium taking over the moment, the most sickening thought to Edgar was that he was going to have to call June. He was going to have to say, "This is the worst yet." He was going to have to give her news which would only drive her down further. He was going to have to say what they had been saying for years. "We have a problem, a crisis. You need to come here. We have to straighten this out." He was going to have to ask her again to rise, memorably, to the occasion, to closet her own suffering, and to focus on the desperate task of salvaging Niall. "Lord Niall," he said. He was sick. There was a fantasy Edgar had, a grisly, impossible vision that had come to him once and repeatedly beckoned him back. The cruel Lorelei of the sickest kind of self-punishment. He was 85 and terminal, and trying to figure out what to do with Niall, how to protect him from the savagery of the world, much as he tried when Niall was 12 and 13 to protect him from the insolent, heavy-lidded-looking boys at school who beat Niall and stole from him with utterly no fear of reprisal. Cowering so desperately in need of his father's protection, Niall could seem precious to Edgar. But in this fantasy, Edgar realized there was no way to save Niall. He would not grow wiser or stronger. In mercy, Edgar would have no choice but to kill them both. It was a dream, actually. That was how these thoughts had started. But it had been enough to make him weep, seeing the gun in the dream and waiting, hoping his son would turn his head, because there was no way to do this if he had to face him. Shoot fast, he always thought, when he tried to turn the vision away and could not. Shoot fast, so you don't have to live for that instant in between. "We have to fix this, Niall. We have a chance to make this right before any real damage is done. I want to know how I can get in touch with Hardcore, and your career as a drug courier is over. It's done, right now." "No," said Niall. He stood up. He actually seemed horrified by Edgar's declaration. "Right now." "Fuck you," he answered. He was gone from the house in a few minutes and did not return.
Hardcore. They were some motherfuckers, some white motherfuckers, who know they own the motherfucking world. You could tighten up on these motherfuckers, jam them up, put you a strap right in their motherfucking face, and it don't matter none. Cause this motherfucker, till the minute he be motherfucking dead, he's still thinking, "Damn, nigga, I am the motherfucking owner of this motherfucking world. And what all you gonna do with a motherfucker like that?" 1 o'clock, bright in the daytime, now daddy rolled in. Homies get up under him, soon pop his ass to see his face, and he's still going, "Where all Hardcore at, man? Damn, I a senator and shit. I want to talk to his ass." Core told Bug, "Bring that fool up here. Motherfucker make me laugh." And then he come through the door up at Central on 17. Not so much as sup. Not as much as how you do. He just raining on Core how he can't be having none of this shit. "I'm sorry you think I've shortchanged you or misled you somehow, but what Niall is doing for you, that has to stop. That cannot and will not continue. I'm sorry." "He's sorry." Core just shook his head at the thought. "Damn, man, you in my crib?" He pointed to the cement floor where there was nothing but 3 telephones and their cords. "You don't be telling me where I sit, where I stand in my crib, because it's my crib. This son of you, he a grown-up man, ain't he?" "You know Niall." "Yeah, he my P.O. Hardcore could not suppress a minute smile. a moment of pure whimsy at the notion of the state and its bureaucratic ineptitude allowing such a pitiful mismatch. He can decide for his own self. I've decided. This is done, Ordell. I'm in this now. I know, so I'm implicated. I can't take that chance myself, and I certainly can't take it for Niall. Damn, man, so what you aiming for me to do here? Just gonna say, hey, Holmes, ain't gonna be no shit this week. You all just get yourself strung out and shit, cause now Daddy say no, cause he complicated. That's how I supposed to do all mine? Nah, motherfucker. When I say cool, then it be motherfucking cool. And it ain't now. Niall's daddy just stood and did him a minute with his eyes. This mother, just some lumpy little white man, but he got him eyes like a spook, going like, it's on, motherfucker, cause ain't no nigga gonna work on me. Ordell, if I hear you're trying to involve him in any more, I'm going with Niall and the best lawyer I can find straight to the PA. Cor laughed then. Cor came right up in his face. You gonna tell the PA what a dope peddling fool he been? I don't think so, motherfucker. You gonna turn on your own kin? I don't think so. Damn, motherfucker, he may as well plead guilty to murder. Kind of quantities that boy carry? Pounds of that shit. He a damn organizer, don't you know? He a drug kingpin. He gonna be on the wall for life, Jack. Niall's daddy, he be shaking his head the whole time Cor spoke. Not if he talks, Ordell. Not if he gives him you. Cor very nearly busted a cap in Edgar right here. Like they took his own dogs and beat the motherfucker dead. Only he needed time for that. He needed to think. No, Hardcore said. You sure enough right about that. He beef me out, ain't gonna be life, no parole. Only gonna be 15, no parole. That's all the minimum mandatory. He could kill somebody's ass and get out sooner. Ain't you one of them mothers thought that shit up? That be the law, man. Ordell, for God's sake, do you know who I am? If I get on that telephone, the PA himself will be on the other end. You really think I can't work this out? It's not the same for me as it is for you. You know it, Ordell, and I know it. So let's not kid ourselves, because we're both too intelligent for that. That was it. Too much. He told Bug to get him out. He sighted Edgar down the length of his finger. Head up, motherfucker. Your ass here anymore, you gonna have a dead ass. I ain't talking shit here. Word up. Motherfucker come in his crib and do him like that. Be a dead motherfucker now, and he don't know it. Motherfucking owner of the motherfucking world. Cor had Bug call Niall at probation. Took him 3 whole days to get himself there, but he come. Hardcore knew he would. He jumped in his shit as soon as Niall was out his ride. Ripped him right there on the street. Man, what the fuck you gone and done? He asked. And now, this silly opie motherfucker with all that greasy hair and shit, hippie motherfucker or something, he like he got whooped in the gut. He can't even talk. Cor, he said. I just told him, man. I had to. Had to what? So he kick your butt? Man, I don't fall to none of this shit. I don't comprehend it, you know? My daddy, man, he just some fool on the corner, man. I see him, I book. What kind of shit you putting down here? Had to tell him. Cor worked his mouth around the spit, then did it. A long glob to the dirty, broken walk. This was just some unbelievable shit, Niall and his daddy. Like to make him want to smoke them both. That daddy yawn, man, he piss off the good humor, man. You hear me? He one of them uptight motherfuckers. Think he always running changes on you, see? You know, like he be fucking Charlie Chan or something, you know? Number one son, all that shit. He a cold, deadly motherfucker. Stand right up on me and say he gonna snitch me out? Ain't no motherfucker on the street down me like that. I kill their ass soon as look at him. Cor walked a few paces in pure agitation and turned back to Niall. So you gonna beef me out, motherfucker? Course not. So what all gonna jump off here then, huh? You hate this motherfucker or what? Edgar? Fuck yeah, Charlie Chan, you hate him? You gonna let him do you like that? No, Niall said mildly. But I mean, He got dumb like he do, can't even think to talk or move. I mean, what choice do I have? On the street, man, standing around chilling, every dude say he a man. Every bro is down for his, but it ain't but half strap up. And in the joint, you see the same. All these proud, tough motherfuckers claiming goobers, whoop them some, and they be begging, don't do me like that, I ain't representing no one. But now, man, he was the lamest, the weakest. Like to think he was a punk, but the stiff dick motherfucker busy now with his skinny little hoe. She suck you dick, man? Ain't no better than she polishing you shoes. But now, he like that too. Straight down, man. You tell that daddy and you're on this. You tell him. Of course, say you'll be here 6:15 tomorrow morning. Gonna meet in the street, man.
For what? What are you gonna do?
Gonna tell him the word, man. Ain't no fool. He ain't even think, that motherfucker. He think he the owner of the motherfucking world, man. And he don't even know I got plans of my own. What kind of dumb motherfucker he think I been? Man, you insurance now. I got you fingerprints and all over all that dope money, man. I been saving that shit up like in the bank. I dime on you, man. PA gonna call me sir. Best do like I say. And he be saying, you gonna beef on me? Bullshit. What proof he got? Now I made a face. Don't be an asshole, man. I been cool. You don't have to diss me like that. I ain't dissing. I ain't hissing or dissing. I ain't fucking you, mama. This just how it be, man. It cold, man. That's all I'm gonna tell your daddy. Tell him, daddy, man, it's too late. Too late. Trust me or bust me, man, and you ain't gonna bust me. Hear? Now I looked at him. Those lame eyes skittering like bugs. Hardcore could hardly stand it. Listen up, dude. You hate this motherfucker worse than I do. Ain't that straight shit now? Ain't nothing gonna happen here you wouldn't done yourself. You do like I'm saying. Ain't nothing for you to do after that. Hear? Core took Niles' chin. He made him look at him like he hated to do. Listen here, he said. I be your daddy now.
June. Fear and danger. Well, she'd been here before. Driving, June felt her pulse stirring in unlikely places, above her elbows, in her neck, beneath the points of her chin. Anxiety, danger always had divided her. A fat old woman, cheerful and controlled, gripped the wheel of Edgar's Nova, careful not to let the needle of the speedometer drift even a mile over the limit. Shrunken down inside her was someone else, ready to sing out in terror. She'd been here before. Her hair roots, her nipples, her fingertips juiced with adrenal output. She tuned in dusty radio for a second, hoping for some great old tune, and then thought, no, no, too much, way too much. And laughing at herself, drove on, into DuSable toward Grace Street. The large forms were somehow shocking after the low, soft shapes of the prairie. How could humans live like this, exist at such close quarters, with the sacred, saving earth from which life sprang paved over beneath their feet? A kid who looked to have been up all night, gunned by in an old, jacked-up blue deuce and a quarter, mouthing dirty words in Spanish, the decorative fringe of an old bedspread shimmying in his rear window. Were those the best years, she wondered suddenly, those years of danger? How could they be? She had been so miserable by the end, frightened of everything, of Edgar and of herself, of what she had done. She was the one who demanded they look after Michael. She parted from Edgar to do it, insisting they could not simply leave wreckage in their wake. How could it seem so wonderful now? She asked Edgar a few years ago when she was in town, apropos of absolutely nothing. She asked, "Do you ever think about that time?" He answered, "No." Not an instant's hesitation. No. It was gone. It could not be reclaimed. It was gone. Like his childhood, like their marriage, like the many events of everyone's past that meant something when they were happening but would never return. When she looked back to those years, the years with Edgar, from the start to the end, there was always a universe of stalled feelings inside her. At the planetarium here in the city, you could sit and watch the stars turn about you as the Earth moved through a season, a year. Living with Edgar was like that. It always seemed as if he were the single point around which the whole moving panorama of the sky turned. Him and her, because she was beside him. She never spoke to anyone about Edgar. There was never anyone else who understood, not now, not then. Perhaps she did not understand herself. In bed with various men years ago, she sometimes mentioned his problems as if trying to save somebody's opinion. It was always the same routine, lying there, smoking cigarettes, watching the ceiling, because she did not want to think about who in particular was next to her. And in this mood of celestial detachment, she would remark how Edgar had been more or less incapable since Niall's birth. Did she want them to know she needed less than they might think? Of course, in those days, she would have laughed at the word unfaithful. Doctrine forbade chattelizing any relationship. She was not Edgar's possession. It was a piece of regressive patrimony to say that her pleasure was not her own business. But she remembered all of that, sleeping with his colleagues, stretching her body against a dozen men she did not know well, allowing them inside her. She remembered it with shame, because Edgar was there anyway, and they both knew it. She had never loved anyone the same way, not before or since. Thank God. Thank God. He was a divine, beautiful thing when he started out. She loved him in the illusion-haloed manner of a teen. This beautiful young man with incredible eyes who spoke about God with an unnerving intimacy. She'd been raised in a religious home. Her mother passed hours on the veranda with an iced tea and the Bible on her lap. She died rocking and trying to decipher the same verses she'd read her whole life. Secretly, from childhood forward, June had believed none of it. And yet when Edgar spoke, she believed she had met the man, there had to be a man, to take her to the greater life out there. It was some variant, she supposed, on the idea of heaven, that there was a better life here on earth, too. He was inspired, on fire with the rage to make that better life. Teach me, she thought. Share it. She was so jealous of his faith, the more so when she realized years on that the only real expression of Edgar's passion was for the people who were not close to him. He loved the poor like puppets, like dolls, a love that left him in complete control. For Niall, for her, impotent was the right word. But his passion was like the heat of the sun. She always knew it was really the love he wanted to feel for them. In the years since, Edgar and she had both come to assume, without ever saying it, that their demise was her fault. She'd wanted his faith and could not have it. She could not believe what he believed, and so she took it from him. Believe something else, she said, something I can share. Revolution. Oh, she had believed in that. Sanctified by revolution, reformed by revolution. Everything errant in her life would be corrected. She challenged poor Edgar, because he was always her example. How much can you believe? She wanted to know. How much faith can you have? Are you still pure? If I let other men inside me. That was her challenge. And he took it up in his own way and eventually invited himself into those beds. Not in the lurid sense that he ever wanted details, but her love affairs, her animal needs, had to serve the revolution somehow. And in that way, Edgar, with his stillborn loving, remained, in the way he always had to be, supreme. I think this could be dangerous, Edgar had said, holding the car keys this morning. He's my son, too. I'm not questioning your devotion, June. I don't think it's safe. I know it's not safe. Ego and self-esteem are what really move the folks down there. I think we should do what I told Ordell we were going to do. We should take Niall and go to the PA. I know him. Edgar, stop. Stop the heroism and the scheming. It's no answer. That's a disaster for you, and especially for Niall. Even Michael will be jeopardized if you're not careful. That's asking to destroy everyone. You should speak to a lawyer before you do anything, and you shouldn't do that until I've talked to this fellow now. June. It's dangerous. I wouldn't be surprised if he's got half a mind to kill me. Maybe more than half. This is too dangerous for anyone. It's not as dangerous for me as it is for you. I'm a fat old woman. I'm not going to threaten anyone. Give me the keys. I'll call as soon as we're through. So here she was again, on one of Edgar's missions. God, the places she had gone in this life. She thought about the Panther safe houses to which Edgar used to send her. What a crazy scene. With the guns all over, the automatic weapons fully loaded, leaning against the wall much as a farmer would lean his hoe. Bandoliers of rounds in full metal jacket looped over the rifle barrels. The windows were newspapered so the cops and FBI could not see inside. Near the end, after the Oakland Armory raid, there was military issue about M-16s and M-79s, ammunition boxes, blasting caps piled into a green duffel marked by Stencil Company A, 92nd Engineers, and the M-18 smoke grenades and C-4 plastic explosives. Sometimes there was cocaine piled up on a table like flour. And always women and babies crawling underfoot, among the men in berets and boots. Edgar had nearly been shot half a dozen times in those places. Someone was always pulling a gun on him, angered not so much by his opinions as by his manner. He looked down the barrel of the gun, implacable. She, everybody there, everyone but Edgar, saw the same thing in him, a southern boy refusing to bend to their rage. But Edgar would not flinch. He thought about his death, the need to die for the revolution every day. And he never let those incidents pass. He believed in discipline. When poor Cleveland was released from the Alameda County Jail, when they bailed him after he had snitched out Michael, Edgar could barely wait to get to the inevitable denouement. He made a show of good cheer, but the last time they saw Cleveland, the morning he was killed, Edgar took a .44 and fired off a round and laid the muzzle, hot enough to burn, right against Cleveland's temple. He left a mark and didn't say a word, even as Martin Kellett and two Panthers grabbed Cleveland. The mark of Cain, she thought now. It was all so crazy. About much of it, about Cleveland's death, for example, she had been too sorry since to live much of a life. She had gone down, fallen helplessly into the chasm. She had made a silly marriage to a handsome, empty man, a man who was even somewhat cruel. He gave her drugs, and she took that for love. They broke up. She took the cure, but started drinking again 7 years ago, and now she drank too much every day. She sat up nights, lapping up cheap Bordeaux by the liter and playing computer solitaire. Now she made a right and came closer to the projects. She could see the blunt towers looming over the rows of industrial buildings, the final structures before the blocks of wasteland around Grace Street. There were old foundries with smokestacks, like arms raised in warning, warehouses with huge gantry doors, all the buildings guarded by razor wire atop their fences. What was in there to steal? The few faces on the streets now, as the early morning dark was starting to dissolve, were black, and in her present mood of recollection she thought of Mississippi in the old days, and the God-fearing simple people they wanted to help, people who were so good. So radiantly good, they seemed almost angelic, suffering their life of deprivation and toil. Lord, she loved to leave the churches, the meetings on Sunday nights in summer. The southern air hung like a damp sock, and the broken light of the moon silvered the trees and the bosques of the heavy landscape. She loved to hear the singing voices rising, gathered together and holding, like the voice of history, to a single note. How could we have gone from there to here with so little gained? She wondered. How could we have raised up these despairing children, dispossessed, who felt from their first moments there was no place on earth for them, who were untouched, unsaved by any tradition of human nobility? How could this have occurred? We were right, she thought, suddenly, desperately. We were right. That was why she was here now in the cold hand of danger. She was doing what she'd done 100 times before, saving him, saving Edgar, this beautiful, passionate boy, because she had to save everything he believed in, because she had no faith in herself. But oh, she had believed in him, in revolution, and she claimed some fragment of that surging feeling now as she swung onto the street. She rolled the window down and smiled absurdly.
Lady,
a young woman said, a perfectly beautiful young woman with flawless, chocolatey skin. She had a stocking cap tugged down over most of her face.
Lady, she said, you in the wrong damn place.
April 2nd, 1996. Seth. So this is how it happens, Seth thinks. You hassle the guy inside your head for 25 years, and then you walk up to his door on a Tuesday morning and knock, and here he is, holding his half-framed glasses and today's newspaper. Edgar is stock still behind the screen door.
Is this about Niall?
He finally asks.
Is he in more trouble?
I hope not. Edgar undertakes another instant of visible deliberation, his face obscured in the deep shadows of early morning. Seth waits on the tongue and groove porch that wraps around the front of the old frame house.
I was about to make a cup of tea,
Edgar finally offers, and nudges the door open a few inches. The interior architecture is baffling. The corridor goes on forever, and the air is heavy with the scent of frying oil and gathered human smells, a little like a barracks.
Have you heard from him?
Edgar asks when they reach the small kitchen. Seth removes the paper Hobie gave him last night, the microfiche from the delivery company showing Michael's address. Edgar puts the kettle on to boil and replaces his glasses before taking up the record.
Am I being threatened?
He asks then. I'm trying to put some things together, Edgar. It's not a threat.
Quite certain? Not planning any reunions with the FBI? No confessional in your column? You see, I want to be sure we aren't going to have another act in that morality play in the courtroom. The Revengers tragedy? Isn't there a drama of that name? I believe June studied it.
Edgar coughs at the moment, a rattling attack on his lungs. He holds a fist before his mouth.
But I suppose your impulse for vengeance is, well, satisfied at this point.
Edgar smiles solely for his own benefit.
What is it you want to know, Seth?
The truth? There was a lot of lying in that courtroom.
Surely not by me, says Edgar. It was your friend Tuttle who distorted the facts.
He stands somewhat stiffly and returns to the whistling kettle, casting about the kitchen to find a second cup. When he opens the refrigerator for milk, it is largely bare, holding only a dairy carton, a gallon jug of water, and a single green olive and a red pimento, separated and floating in half a jar of greenish juice.
Is he crazy or melodramatic?
Edgar asks. Hobie?
More a performance artist. That's how I think of him.
The word as gesture.
He's a treacherous person.
Edgar shakes his head at the thought and places both cups, curling steam, on the table.
I'm sure you had a good time watching Hobie play with my life. I assume you felt it was appropriate, because you think I played with yours. Didn't you?
Edgar takes his time with that. Across the table, he folds his hands carefully.
I took advantage of a circumstance, Seth. There were careful plans, and they went awry. Someone was arrested quite accidentally. He started blabbing. So I seized an opportunity. Yes, I did. Unkind, probably. Yet I was confident and correct, as it turned out. It would work out for all of us.
The greatest good for the greatest number, Edgar? Including number one.
It was a long time ago, Seth.
Are you invoking the statute of limitations? I thought there wasn't one on murder. Edgar's eyes squeeze shut then, and Seth eases forward in the beaten old kitchen chair. The maple table between them is small, stained with berry juice in one place, a relic of many decades' use in Edgar's household. I want you to understand something, Edgar. I'm as old now as you were then, older, I guess, and I blame myself, first and foremost. The things I did, not you. But if I was Tsar of the Universe or the Lord High Executioner, you'd be punished. You escaped, and it bothers me, man. It kills me. How come everyone suffered but you, Edgar? Don't you ask yourself, do you think about them, Edgar? The lives you took? The ones you ruined? Seth stabs a finger down on the paper he brought. How do you sleep at night, for God's sake? Edgar takes the question with a taut, slightly whimsical expression. Well, he doesn't sleep at night. Seth can read that thought. There is a small window at Edgar's back, and in the early morning light, his face is haggard. A day's growth clings to his cheeks like a sugared topping.
Do you know people who fought wars, Seth? I fought a war, yes. There were casualties, and I rue them. I mourn for them. But I certainly didn't turn my back on Michael. That should be obvious.
His face dips toward the paper on the table.
I gave him every kind of support imaginable for years. My wife and my son essentially abandoned me to see after him. With my consent. Yet it wasn't in repentance. Because I don't repent.
Edgar's face is raised at that characteristic angle of willful invulnerability. But this much no doubt is true. Seth thought about it all night and realized it wasn't charity or grief that motivated Edgar to care for Michael from this distance all this time. No. Michael was the man Edgar could not be. To June, a lover. To Niall, a gentle, guiding hand. He was Edgar's own lost fragment. He could no more let go of Michael than himself. But Edgar doesn't see that part. His justification, as ever, lies in history.
I had something to fight against, says Edgar. And I fought. And the war I fought still makes more sense to me than many of the wars waged in this country. The Indian Wars, the Spanish-American War, the Mexican-American War, Vietnam. I believe, as I believed even then and was afraid to say to myself, I believe I shall be judged, and I don't fear it. But don't you dare think I did not suffer, then or now, because I have. I have. I have paid prices you cannot imagine.
Red creeps up Edgar's scalp, and he winds himself away in a momentary effort to contain his anguish.
And don't think I'm speaking about what you and your friend did to me in that courtroom. I care much less than you might suppose for my reputation.
That wasn't what he thought. June is what Seth guesses. June was Edgar's anguish, a whirlwind of torment right up to the terrible end. What did we do to you in that courtroom? Seth asks.
Oh, please, Seth. I'm old. I'm not addled. You had to have been part of that.
Of what?
You know this story. You must. And Edgar begins to serve out the details as a challenge. You must know, he says, about the dope, the jail, about Niall and Hardcore. You must know, he repeats. No, Seth says. His reaction, the pallor, the faltering, brings Edgar up short, and he responds more sparingly as Seth begins to question him. But he answers. The story is told, about sending the DFU money to Michael, about this young girl, Lavinia, and, most despairingly, about Edgar's confrontations with Hardcore. Only at the end does Edgar permit his full glance to fall again on Seth. Even in age, his eyes have remained remarkable. Seth does not remember when he developed the impression that wolves have eyes this color, glacial blue, an outward aspect of beauty and tranquility, concealing a teeming, unmanaged spirit. This was all unknown to you? Edgar asks again. Unknown, says Seth. Still in doubt, Edgar stands arthritically for a second cup of tea and speaks as he's standing at the stove, describing the game of prisoner's dilemma that Cor and whoever advised him played. They were mutual hostages, Niall and Hardcore. When June was killed, Edgar understood at once that it was not an accident. But what was he to say? The truth would put Niall in the penitentiary. He remained silent, never guessing that the police would be able to build a case on Hardcore, or what Ordell would do as a result. But there was not a lawyer Edgar spoke to after Cor had implicated Niall who did not say the same thing. Niall would do less time for a crime of family passion than for distributing pounds of narcotics in the course of abusing a public